Swiss physician Johannes Hofer coined the term nostalgia in his 1688 medical dissertation, from the Greek nostos, or homecoming, and algos, or pain. The disease was similar to paranoia, except the sufferer was manic with longing and feelings of anxiety and emptiness. It was considered similar in diagnosis to melancholy, except specifically directed to an object or place. In the context of our modern dilemma, nostalgia could be defined as looking at the past, opining for simpler, happier times, and believing our origins hold the truth to escaping the dangers of the present. Its antithesis is futurism, which attempts to look idealistically towards the possibilities of the future, assuming it holds the truth to escape the dangers of the present. Should we, as a species, hold at revolt against the conspiracy to destroy the humility that comes from being a frail creature made in his image, and go back to a simpler, easier way? Or is the solution to smash our preconceived notions of what it is to be human and strive for a new form more capable of addressing the problems we face as a species? Join us for episode 6 of The Richest Family, Retrogressive Nostalgia and Utopian Futurism, where we discuss longing for the past, idealizing the future, and the transhuman myth. We have here Greg Coles. Wave. Yep. Lifelong tattoo artist, researcher of disco, and friend. We have Magnetic Stripper. Artist, dabbled in tattooing too, which is part of what we're going to be talking about today. Another lifelong friend and weirdo, digital artist, projection guru, and Clay Tantor, that's me. I'm a lifelong coder, hacker, creator, slap tagger, and we're a bunch of Gen X weirdos here to talk about the people looking at the past and people looking at the future. Jim, you usually do a disclaimer. Would you mind jumping in with your disclaimer?
When a speculator needs a speculator, we are the speculators.
Sure.
A body meets a body.
To say that we've built this house upon unstable ground is just a understatement. So basically, the conjecture that we are putting forth would make Leonard Nimoy in his In Search days do a secondary disclaimer. But no, because this is primarily our opinions, I don't think we're in that deep a water this time, Clay.
Yeah. And we're just talking about how we look at some movements and some things that we've seen in the past and how we look towards the future. I would also say we've changed the format just a little bit. We're trying to use style boards a little bit to kind of guide us through our journey, so that's going to be interesting. We're going to try that today. So, Jim, I'd like to kick it off with you and some topics that you've been thinking a little about. When I look at the Trello, I see some stuff about Jules Verne and Sid Mead and things that, like, even toys that we played with as kids about futurism. I'm going to pop over to that. And
So I'm gonna give a little preface here before the slides pop up. Yeah, I guess they have popped up. I'm gonna say some things about futurism that is maybe a little outside of what most people think about it. And the first thing I'm gonna say is, you know, the future is unstuck from a timeline. Every age has their futurism. So we're gonna use a couple of case studies here to get at the crux of what's going on. Delaney kind of made this statement, this is going to be paraphrasing, that Science fiction tells us about the age in which it's written, not really about the future, you know? That a lot of this stuff is, in fact, a projection. And then, you know, there's some things that are precursors to our futurist, concepts that we currently have, like Hermes Trismegistus and the hermetic alchemical thinking, as above, so below, which was a big change in human consciousness, thinking about that. Plato's cave is another one. I know that we've talked about that. The chemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, which I've probably butchered that name, but you know, this is 14.
Rosy Cross.
Exactly. The Rosicrucians. So in this concept in the book is that it takes place in 1459, which it may or may not have. There is a futuristic sphere that the participants get inside of, and it is a fully mechanical internal planetarium.
So does that relate to Victorian futurism?
No, well, I'm just going to say that there are things that kind of happened before the Victorians took it into full steam ahead, right?
Well, there was certainly this big transition process, because most of these scientific principles are springing from mythological understandings. So as people are able to rely more and more on gathering of facts rather than starting from precept, they're trying to make the facts fit the concept that is driving them to observe the facts.
Right. So that's where Descartes came in and basically changed this entire... He said that basically everything was measurable. So what happened around the turn of not this century, but the previous, was that suddenly everyone was caught up in this kind of Cartesian concept. And the concept was that we can use measurement in order to change our world. And this is the Industrial Revolution. This is basically what happened was that there was this kind of transition from just fantastic to a projection of, hey, I think we can actually do this. If we extrapolate what we have now into the future, this is what we will have. So, Victorian futurism, we could talk about the two majors, which would be Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. We have this kind of, what they now call steampunk identity, as in these wily, in most of these stories, there's a wily inventor or a noble inventor who's basically creating these devices because there's this type of latent wanderlust, right? And so...
Yeah, you look at Master of the World, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's the rogue scientist from some obscure part of the world who is deciding that, you know, he wants to force his mythology on the world through force of understanding of real world principles.
That's right. And so basically you have these guys that are, you know, these inventors that want to go into space. They want to, explore the moon. They want to explore the bottom of the ocean. They want to explore the skies. And some of them are heroic and some of them are villains. But this is all things that were speculated on because they had discovered there's the vacuum pump and there's the steam locomotive and there's all these different technologies that are, the radio, right?
Yep. And there were also there was this interesting case in the United States of before there was regulations regarding medicine or regulations regarding advertisement. This guy started as a local doctor with very dubious medical diplomas. A farmer came in, said, "Oh, I'm impotent. What can you do for me?" And he took a goat testicle, sewed it in the guy's scrotum. The guy came back a week later and said, "Doctor, you're a genius." He performed tens of thousands these operations. And there's stuff, there's no blood supply, it's just necrotic, but he's doing it. And it started an empire. He started creating these patent medicines that were just colored water. And it went beyond just a traveling snake oil show. He created North America's most powerful radio projector tower and was able to transmit through almost the entirety of North America, and would have these pseudo medical talk shows where he would have the experts saying, "Oh, you need Johnson's blue water."
Blue water.
He became a millionaire.
I want to ask a question though, Jim. So What I'm hearing from you is there was this kind of almost like real men go into the future. It's humans' duty of bravery, kind of, with the boldly aspect of this. Would you say that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, this concept that, we have polite society, and the thing that makes polite society actually interesting are these, manly man adventurers. So you still needed to have your waxed mustache and your top hat.
So is the future dangerous? It looks like it from these pictures.
Well, that's the thing. It's that you have a kind of cornucopia of benefits from this technology, but people like H.G. Wells, and to a certain degree, Jules Verne and some others, Mary Shelley, said, "Hey, look, one of the issues is that when we create these utopias, for example," H.G. Wells was very big about this, "when we create these utopias, if we were to see them from the Victorian standpoint, they are dystopias."
Yep.
Right? And so there was a lot of social consciousness built in, with H.G. Wells especially. Social consciousness runs through a ton of his stories. Like, War of the Worlds, the most interesting thing about it to me was that when I was a kid, all I could see was the Martians. And then when, I read it recently, all I could see is a proto-socialism going on, an anti-class kind of rhetoric going through the books. Same thing with the time machine.
Well,
right?
That's what I thought was so brilliant about what's his name? Orson Welles' radio show of War of the Worlds. I mean, it's the same story, but putting it in that, newsflash context. People turning on 3 minutes into the show just thought it was the news. I'm sure it was only a certain percentage. I'm sure there's plenty of people who are like, "Yeah, I love Orson," But he actually had to make a public apology. And even as far as the 80s, there were replays of that show in Spain that had people flipping out.
Yep. He basically created a, what's the best way to put it? A sensation, right? And that's one of the things that's interesting in the original, is how when Orson Welles does it, it's about that time.
When
H.G. Wells put it out, it's like people went and had their Victorian picnics watching the Martians come out of this thing, and then, slightly after, people are on fire, right? So this is just kind of the thing. It's like the Victorian concept was that society has this integration, and it has this weird thing that happens when it's up against something unusual. It's a curiosity.
I mean, we're kind of doing all that today too, right? I mean, we're looking towards the future and also afraid of the you know, what it represents. I mean, we're playing it out right now, right?
That's right. That's right.
Like,
it seems like the only thing.
And we, like, in the days of when we were kind of coming up, this was represented in music, right?
It still is. Like, look at the difference between people who, we talked about that in terms of, you know, country music, for example, and classical music and electronic music.
You, like, what do you think of things like Kraftwerk or?
Well, I mean, let's go back further than Kraftwerk. Let's go back to
Aaron Kingsley.
And Raymond Scott. And,
yes, all that baby music. Yeah.
Yeah, baby music for baby and the Radiophonic Workshop, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. I know that you've heard Radiophonic Workshop because you've heard the theme to Doctor Who and the music to Doctor Who.
And in the 50s, there were plenty of the, you know, be like testing your stereo's, you know, range records would be boop. Boop. You know, track 3, 17 hertz. Boop.
Yeah. Okay. So basically what happened was we get to this point and electronic music's primary focus was to create sounds that no one had heard before. And it was very common to have a tag like sounds from the future and music of the future. And
wasn't there a whole dude who did all these kind of commercials around it? Like,
yeah, Raymond Scott.
Barry Lippman was one. All the guys that we know who were famous for making this new age stuff, Jean-Michel Jarre, Tomita, they all cut their teeth making news themes and commercial jingles.
Sure, right. Sure.
You know, all it had to be was like 15 seconds of boop de doop 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 doop. And there you go, payday, right?
What's interesting to me is now that we look back at it, that's kind of nostalgia. We have nostalgia for that, even though they were seeing it as the future and, like, you know, grasping towards this futuristic reality, we're now looking back at it and going, oh, it's so, I love it so much, it makes me feel good.
But the thing that's funny about that is that we say nostalgia, but it's also that a 60-year-old Moog synthesizer is still the sound of the future.
Yeah,
right.
When somebody makes that sound, people would go, it's like aliens, or it's like the sound of outer space, or that sounds like a phaser. You know what I'm saying? It's like the synthesizer is still the sound of the future. In a way, it's an interesting concept that something can be so loaded that even its nostalgia creates enough inertia to make it still futuristic. Like it's propelling itself through all those things, even though it's actually tying together the past, the present when it's being performed on, and the future when, because of that's the projection that it's emitting.
Sure, yeah. That's you know, one thing I think about is when I was a kid, it was kind of idealistic to think about the future. I mean, all the way up to the turn of the century, right up to 2000. And then for some reason, it went downhill. I mean, I had toys that were, you know, specifically, they were around the future. They were based in the future. I had Micronauts. I had
Micronauts,
astronauts, robots, scientists. Yeah.
I had a bunch of shit that was like, the future is cool, you know, and that doesn't really seem to be the case the more futuristic we become.
Well because what I think is that back then the future represented these positive things in your life, like plastics, electronic communication, where I think technology has sort of reached a point beyond the average person's understanding. And in a way, the utility is blurred out the actual mechanism causing it.
Jim, didn't you have a bunch of space toys?
Oh, man. Okay, so let's talk about growing up at the, you know, first memories at the middle to late 60s.
Action Jackson.
Oh, man. So basically, there was a toy line from Mattel. You know, it was literally called the Man in Space, Major Matt Mason and his cohorts. So Major Matt Mason essentially lives on the lunar surface in a world that is a projection of the Chesley Bonstall / Wernher von Braun kind of idea about manned exploration coming out of the 50s and into the 60s. And what's kind of interesting is that you have futuristic architecture, futuristic vehicle design. The characters are, I don't know the best way to put it. It's like they're coming out of NASA's actual design book. So basically, we have this thing that happens with the Apollo missions, and that is that suddenly our futuristic vision matches up with our grasp, and that we actually kind of design things.
The promise was fulfilled. The promise of futurism.
The promise
was
fulfilled. Yeah. And, you know, this is interesting. I had read this description of what actually changed in the toy line, because it didn't really go that much further than 1969, because we landed on the moon. It was too desolate and depressing for people and not fertile enough to say, oh, there's aliens. Because, you know, Major Matt Mason had, you know, aliens and other things going on inside.
Yeah, it's just some rocks and some scientific tests.
Yeah. And so basically, they said, hey, we can't really pursue this toy line. I mean, there's nothing out there. And the vision became as desolate as the scenery. Let's just put it that way. And so instead of this whole thing like, hey, we're going to have a manned mission to the moon, they might find something interesting. What if they found alien artifacts or aliens or you know, it's just now that we are going back to the moon. They just were talking yesterday about finding a superstructure of metallic.
Yeah, and people still aren't into it. You hear this like, we've got all these problems on Earth and...
It's a matter of funding.
You know what? I don't care how much money we're going to have. We're never going to solve this people are starving thing ever. I mean, not until we go to a post-scarcity society and we change our value system where we don't think that the betters should live differently than the lessers, right?
Right.
So, and I think one thing, this is an interesting thing, because I think the futurism, and you can even talk about Star Trek The Next Generation when we talk about futuristic cultures, you know, that's the thing that some people are afraid of, that we might lose the betters and the lessers.
So let's talk about this in terms of, you know, I'm going to butcher his name, Dostoevsky.
Dostoevsky.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's a good quote. Well, gentlemen, why don't we reduce all this meaninglessness to dust with one good kick for the sole purpose of sending these logarithms to the devil and living once more according to our own stupid will?
But that's also someone who's not a scientist intimidated by science. And
yeah,
that is really the reaction of the majority of humans.
Well, that wasn't his reaction. That was him talking about utopia, right? And the fact that human beings, if they're like, you know, I was watching the new series of Brave New World, and I was watching it, and I was like, when I was a kid, I thought this was dystopia. And now I think maybe this is the right idea.
It's the news, man.
It's the right idea. And so the idea that he's talking about is if we were given a utopia, we would kick it into dust.
So it would become unhinged, possibly?
Well, think of all the the things that we have today that would have been like washing machine, running water, flushing toilet. People don't even blink twice about it. But people for the millennia spent the majority of their time taking a bucket of water from the water source to their fucking house, taking that bucket of poop,
that's right,
finding a place for it. How many hours of your day do you want to spend with that stuff? And now people don't even think about it. It's just a flush and a twist of a knob.
That's right. And
there is also this whole, like, in the 60s and 70s, this whole, like, we're going to make it real. There was, like, Arcasante and Paolo Soleri, like, going out in the desert and building these, like, systems. And there was the Whole Earth catalog where they're like, oh, all we have to do is use technology and homesteading and we can do anything on our own. Or Archigram,
who were in the UK. They started about 1960. And they were absolutely insane. And like ideas like building cities on type of mechanized platforms that the city could walk around to different locations and attaching cities to balloons, right? And so the idea of Archigram was that not only were they futurists, they were also kind of more like psychedelic futurists, where they wanted to basically unglue people's preconceptions about what we could actually do and use that as a way to, you know, unhinge society, unhinge the psychology programming that had gone into architecture and basically change the world. So Sid Mead is interesting. We've seen Sid Mead's work in so many
Blade
movies.
Runner.
Blade Runner, yeah. Tron. So basically, What I see is a kind of a difference between Archigram and Sid Mead is that Sid Mead was looking at it as, you know, a futurist, but also as this kind of like product designer. Like these shapes, like let's not say that a product actually got built, but the shape that he put forth became part of a vocabulary of what futuristic was.
Just like with the music, when we think of what the future is, we think of that electronic musical style from Doctor Who.
Or Wendy, Walter Carlos, or, you know, even somebody like Throbbing Gristle or Cabaret Voltaire, you know, creating this kind of projection of either a, you know, utopia or dystopia inside of this futuristic capacity.
Willing to try the new thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I remember seeing an interview with Yellow. You know, they would go to the music store and they wanted to find like new effects pedals. And they're like, what's that thing with the keyboard in the back? And like the guy at the music store didn't even really, it's like, I don't know, it's a synthesizer thing. I don't even really know how it works or whatever. They're like, yeah, well, we'll take one of those. And so they just had to take it. I guess it came with a manual, but they had to teach themselves, you know.
That it's pioneering.
Yeah. You know, and Kraftwerk, their mom put out a record. Their mom was a teacher at a musical college.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they were growing up. They're like, oh, here's a saxophone. Take it apart, right? You know?
So that maybe explains why they tinker
exactly.
So much.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it just seemed like just something you mix and match like fucking Lego.
Well, they were very kind of like, we are going to make this, even though it doesn't exist before.
And they have patents.
That's the boldly go, right?
So absolutely.
I'm going to break in here and kind of do my spiel. And I think one thing that it feels like there's a theme that we've all been kind of talking about is there's this continuum and, you know, just, and it can turn into tribalism where we look at the present and some people are looking to the past and some people are looking to the present and some people are not. And there's a whole spectrum there about how deep that goes. And really, and I think, Jim, you kind of put it in these terms, that nostalgia is someone standing in the present and looking back because they believe that it resolves the fears of the present. And the people who are kind of obsessed with the future – have a kind of idealism that has a disdain for the past and sees it as something to move out of. It has this, you know, this kind of negative connotation of the past and what it represents. And so that's kind of a lens for, you know, how, you know, things like nostalgia happen in our society. And I don't know, I feel like there's more and more nostalgia. It's kind of like right around the year 2000, we kind of flipped. And because I remember in our, when, you know, all of us were kind of running around on the streets like wild men, there was an optimism about the future. There were these people all thinking, oh yeah, this is, the future is going to be great and we're going to do all these cool things and it's going to empower us. And we're going to have, you know, the internet was new. But now there's this kind of looking back and a large group of people who are fighting against that. And, you know, it comes up in stuff like, it happened before. I mean, it was happening all while we were growing up with things like people, you know, loving the Saturday Evening Post and Norman Rockwell and this, you know, idea of getting together with the family TV. With Thanksgiving and, you know, what, you know, the beaver lifestyle with, you know, working a long day with the men and coming home and eating a good meal from somebody who loved you, you know, all the way to, you know, now where we have political figures shilling NFTs that dress them up like cowboys, right?
Can I just chime in on that for a second? My wife really mentioned something that was totally spot on about that last night. That TV, in a way, has given us this sort of false memory of this sort of idealistic life that was the past. It's like even you look at, you know, Father Knows Best, and My Three Sons, at the time, people had, like, you know, like gay relatives or, you know, family structures that were not harmonious. Maybe people were alcoholics or, you know, the same problems that people face today.
And in some levels, it was openly accepted as long as it was humor or comedy or kind of put in its place. If it was put in its place, it was okay.
But this sort of like false memory of what the past was created by the, you know, the TV writers has given people this feeling like, oh, well, real life is fucked up. It's not the way things used to be. And you even hear it so much of the conservative rhetoric about this idealized past that didn't exist. It's their fucking TV memories. It's the fucking Bugs Bunny at Disneyland. You know,
ask a black man about it, right? And they'll say there never were any good old days.
Yeah, no, no. As soon as you start having Jeffersons or That's My Mama, you had a place for that. You know, a place for like, oh, remember back when we were kids and our mama said, no, you kids put your, you know, there was that. As opposed to them trying to be like, what the hell am I? You know, the Amos, right? You know?
One thing that's interesting to me about nostalgia as a concept is that when it was invented, by the reason it came up is people were suffering. It was a disease. And it was something that you know, ailed people. And now it's kind of like really flipped its head. So now all we do is remake comic book movies over and over again, right? So one thing that kind of comes up for me is this is embodying in a very successful artist who kind of really encapsulates and then marketed this whole nostalgia, Thomas Kinkade. And many Plain Kinkade was the most hated artist on the planet by other artists, mostly because his repetitive approach to his work and his critique, and people criticized that he pandered to sentimental longing, which never existed. Like we're talking about now, just like you just said, Greg, it never existed, and it's been reconjured specifically for craven marketing to people who are feeling this longing, who feel this pain. That's why you can sell these NFTs to them. They don't fucking know what an NFT is, but it's being all of them.
Reassured.
Yeah, that's right. So he is considered to be the most financially successful artist of all times. When he died of pretty much self-abuse, I think through alcohol, I'm not sure, but you know, he was a troubled guy, and when he died in 2012, his net worth was $70 million, and he did it by creating, like, mall shops. You know, he sold his art in the mall. And Disney, he did, like, all these, he had these licensed Disney things that he did, right? You know, and Disney's the epitome of nostalgia, you know, the Disney princess, right? So...
Well, that sort of has a basis in ceramics, like Meissen ceramics. You really see a lot of Thomas Kinkade and Disney is sort of like storybook aesthetic coming from these German ceramics.
That's right. Like Hummel figurines. It's like Thomas Kinkade paintings are interesting in that they're a simulacrum that's not a painting of a real building. It's a painting of a Hummel figurine.
Yeah, yes.
And I know this because at one point we built this Christmas Village project, right? And so we bought all these figurines and I was like, this looks like a Thomas Kinkade village. And the weird thing was when I looked at the box, it was like Thomas Kinkade's Christmas Village. And they were actual ceramic figurine sets. And I was like, this is what he's painting. He's not painting a real house covered with snow. He's painting a freaking ceramic product that is something that they sell to, you know, old ladies have on their shelf.
Yeah, yeah, something Christmas. Familiar, you know, a fancier version of what they've already got.
So this is something that I wanted to bring up, Clay, is that what's interesting is how much nostalgia is futurism's kind of like evil twin in the sense
agreed.
That, well, there's a flipping point. You were saying around the year 2000, all of a sudden we had this shift backwards. You know, one of the things that happened around that time that a lot of people forget. Well, wait a second. One thing that happened around that time that people seem to forget is living in the moment.
Right.
Right. And so living in the moment basically says all that futurism stuff that who knows, we might not live long enough to see it. And all that nostalgia stuff that's dead and in the past. Did the past even exist? Right. So what's left? Well, there's the only thing that we actually experience, which is right now.
Oh, okay. So I do have a lot of thoughts about that. And you know, that gets into Buddhism, and I'm a practicing Buddhist. We can't go into that topic.
Absolutely.
We make another
that is just a lead into a future
it
show.
It absolutely is related in everything you're saying. Let's just kind of point to that right now and say that it is a thing, and I'll agree with you.
I got a little spiel that relates to that. So let's talk about the Royal Society. So this was that transition of that working from an idealism towards the facts versus gathering facts to create a concept. So there was this guy, you know, had the curly mustache, was a landowner, you know, very much the British gentleman of the Royal Society. And he's like, okay, you know, people are digging up these cavemen in Africa and stuff, but we need a proper British caveman. So he digs in his own garden and finds a skull that's a human jawbone on a gorilla's skull and just puts it together and say, oh, lo and behold, I found Piltdown Man, you know, Britain's earliest. And look how pronounced that jaw is. He's obviously an Englishman, you know. And he puts this thing forth for years and years until finally after his death, his gardener, who was his helper, said like, yeah, we just built this stuff. You know,
it's all a hoax.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of really good hoaxes, Greg. So I want to transition to the other side of this, which is the futurism. And it has this pretty deep history. It's arguable who invented it, but a lot of people argue that it was Peridune Estestuary. I think that's how you say his name. But he changed his name to FM2030 because he thought names were these monikers of the past, right? This guy was pretty fucking hardcore. And it's arguable that, like, many of the futurist concepts of future idealism and really came from him, including he had all these terms that somewhat are coming out, like post-genderism. I mean, that's kind of what gender fluidity is now, right? And communitarianism and mobilia, this idea that, and, you know, we won't only have a nuclear family, which was the first stage of it, but then really all human beings will be these independent things that move through any kind of time and space, right? Or as they wish, which kind of is coming true also. We're becoming way more isolated. And I think that's, you know, almost an ideal in his world. But then it evolved into all these kind of, this was real big back, you know, around the early 2000s, late 1990s, you know, all these guys that had these life enhancement treatments and, like,
oh, Dirk drink, and Sandy Shaw.
Right, exactly. If you drink this supplement, your brain will be a, you know, ginkgo biloba and, you know, human enhancement, right? And this was Max Moore kind of, like, got famous during this time. And they founded the Humanity Plus, the Transhuman Society, and all of that stuff is mostly around this human enhancement aspect. You know, we're going to plug in chips in our fucking brain and download I Know Kung Fu, you know, this kind of stuff, right? And then there's what we're really familiar now, talked about around AI, which is the singularity, which really Ray owes to Werner Vinge, who wrote Gravity's Rainbow. I mean, this guy is a writer. He wrote, in 93, he wrote a thing on the coming technological singularity, and Ray Kurzweil just ran with it, right? So we think Kurzweil invented it just because he's, you know, a technocrat that everybody knows about, but it was really Werner Vinge. And that's this general artificial intelligence thing that's kind of coming into being now, where we're going to augment our brains, we're going to use AIs. And not only that, technology will start moving so fast that it's out of control. I mean, we can't control it anymore, and we're almost going to have to react to it more than...
Well, I think we're kind of reaching that stage with the proliferation of AI, because I don't think that the human's understanding has gotten beyond, like, the Forbin Project or some episode of Star Trek, where very few people really get the utility of it and are just reacting to some Saturday morning TV show where AI just kind of popped out of their screen and took over their house or something.
Well, you know, there's something really interesting that I think that people don't step back far enough to see. They don't get enough perspective to see it. And that is the levels of technology on the Earth go from basically people who are Neolithic and Paleolithic, yes, all the way into super sciences that might not even be cataloged. Because if you think about it, getting back to the Victorians, people in their garages have done some insane things.
Made homemade radios.
A lot of times, they don't want that stuff to be caught up in the typical lines of what how technology is deployed or understood, and that we might be looking at a level of super science in AI that's not part of our understanding in the corporate.
Well, okay. I think this idea, one of the things that gets into a lot of science fiction writing, like, you know, William Gibson or whatever, is like there's this moment in time where the AI awakened. I mean, if that's in the negative form, that's like Terminator. It awakened.
The Kraken.
And yes. Nothing was ever the same again, right? We
But it was always an immediate negative connotation, too.
Well, but there's a positive one, too. There's all,
in real life, but I'm saying the literary
there's some people who welcome this like they would welcome, like we were talking about before, the AI God. This thing is going to protect us from ourselves. This thing is going to, see the truth where we can't because we have all this, this human baggage. And it's going to actually do what's best for us, right? But there's the negative, which is that Terminator is going to wake up and figure out we're assholes and kill us all, right?
Well, you see, so much of the fictitious negative view of AIs, we're basing it on human behavior. So now what I think is a really interesting insight into human behavior was the quarantine. The entire world had to stay in their house and get on the internet. And everyone started to get sort of weird and creepy. But weird and creepy was the tangible force that pulled these people together. And that, to me, is the scary part of AI. Because its understanding of human psychology is infinite, better than any human psychologist. And is just going to feed what the crazy people want to see. And that will become the dominant paradigm because it's so much easier to be crazy than rational.
Yeah, but then there's also the cyber, the original kind of cybernet, not cyberpunk, but cybernetic outlook of like the late 50s, early 60s, which spawned things like All Watched Over by Machines of Love and Grace, right?
Well, because
the idea that it's part of, that it could become part of an ecology. The Buddhist, when asked about AI, have said, look, if the thing is alive, then it's just part of nature also, right? Yep. And so part of what we have to address is, are we going to address this as an alien that's come into our world? Are we going to address it as a part of our nature? And I think that makes a big difference.
It
about
does.
The outcome.
That's a great point. Right lately, though, as a society, in terms of futurism, we've been, because AI have come on the scene, we're focused on it. But futurism has all this other elements, too, like how can I make my body different or better? And Stellark was this
Stellark is great.
Who kind of played him with that before anybody else. He actually had an ear surgically implanted on himself, and it was definitely in the transhuman kind of philosophy.
He had an artificial third arm that
the whole performance was, his basic statement was the human body is obsolete or will be obsolete, right? I think that's where he's coming from. Well, Jim, you knew some of the people who ran that thing over at Gray Matter. Wasn't it Gray Matter who did that?
Yeah. And so Stellark came and did a did kind of a seminar on his projects. And it was very interesting when I met Fakir, who is kind of a polar opposite of Stellark.
They're both doing the piercing body suspension.
Yeah. But this is interesting. I said, hey, Fakir, it's interesting how much you remind me of Stellark, and he said we are polar opposites
in the sense that
I believe I am a spirit that's inside of a shell, and I've decorated my shell, and I use my shell to allow the spirit to manifest. Whereby Stellark is a meat machine, and basically uses the modifications to say that we can be other things besides just this form of meat machine. But he has no interest whatsoever in the kind of new age.
No, that's
spiritualism.
It's
all
vapor.
Mechanical.
That's vapor to him.
Right. And so in a way, Stellark is going back towards more like Native Americans and modern primitivism, whereby Stellark is transhumanist.
Greg, isn't that your tattoo on the cover? Didn't you?
That's me. That was Hillary. In fact, I was at a...
Were you in a relationship with her?
Yeah. We lived together. Sure, yeah. We lived together for years, And that was when I was first starting a tattoo. And yeah, I just drew something on her, and that was that, you know. But I saw Fakir at this performance where at first a very small gallery situation. It was not like a stage and seats. And he's just another person in the crowd. And then suddenly he opens up his shirt and then sticks this metal bar. Oh, he's sitting and typing at a typewriter. And then he takes his metal bar and sticks it through his giant chest piercings. And then starts carrying his typewriter around by his boobs. And he's like dancing around and typing on his typewriter.
Yeah, that guy was next level. Like
3-4 feet from him. No stage, no nothing. He's just in the audience with you.
But I think the thing about modern primitives that's interesting, and it really lines up with this, because they were saying, look, we want to look to the past. It wasn't a nostalgic look at the past in the sense of, oh, this will make me feel good. It was this kind of like the past tribal activities of humans is essential to our mental health. And that's right. A different thing than nostalgia in my mind. It's because it was a lot of just for the present.
Well, it was also being the thing as opposed to outside looking at it.
That's right. And it was also talking about that our path after the 1950s, kind of forward through Nixon, through a lot of these kind of, we had set up a very, very, very fossilized identity system. And that fossilized identity system systemically eradicated tribalism and a lot of these other processes that were actually beneficial to human beings in their further evolution.
Yes.
And so in a way, modern primitivism was in fact a type of we could call it retrofuturism, even.
Exactly.
You know? And if you see some of the people who got involved with that, Psychic TV, a lot of the people who were in the industrial culture.
Early movement, William Gibson short stories, the low tech.
It's all through. And Johnny Mnemonic. All through.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, all the biomodification that he talks about in Neuromancer.
Became real.
But it's also things that are tied to what tribal people had done in order to change their appearances.
Yes.
So that there's a type of like body modification and style that's now coming forward, which to me is more aligned with this transhuman kind of concept, and that's that post-humanism. There's this group, Fecal Matter, and I think they do represent the idea of posthumanism in terms of what you're talking about, Jim, which is body modification and enhancement and taking basically transhuman to becoming beyond, no longer human. In other words, the ideal form is to reject this human form and maybe even on some level, you know, to modify this human body completely. I have a lot of feelings about this. I don't know. I don't want to judge, but it doesn't feel like an idealistic form. What do you guys think of it?
Well, any form of tool usage is an extension of that. You know, you got a stick. Hey, I can reach something that I can reach.
Does that hammer look ugly in my hand? I mean, how would I judge that? Oh, now you're ugly. You picked up.
Well, it's interesting to see how polarized the commentary about Fecal Matter's look is, because you will see a 50-50 split, which is very, very interesting in that I think that the world is basically represented in this sampling, 50-50 split of people who love them and people who hate them. Like people who look at it and say, this is art that's trying to talk about alienation and how aliens exist inside of our society. And that is the others. Like they are the ultimate others.
We have seen the aliens and they are us, ironically.
That's right. Right. That's right. That's right. But then you'll see Fecal Matter puts on their makeup. And it's very strange how somebody who wears a pair of high heels that are made to look like human skin are really down to earth, kind of very sensitive artist types, intellectual, right? Whereby you look at them and they just look like, you know, that they would have to take some type of mutant algae, Bandersnatch.
Karen Finley's like that,
weird,
right?
Weird, you know, like they wouldn't even eat what we eat,
yes.
Right? Maybe in some of their incarnations, they don't even have mouths, right? And so what they are in a lot of ways is getting us ready for what if we are spliced? What if we are augmented to the point where our bodies are shaped really different from human? So in a way, they're the harbingers of the potential of future change.
Well, Jerusalem, and like looking for New Jerusalem, this could segue a little bit to you, Greg. There was this whole idea of finding New Jerusalem as almost like a city of God on earth or heaven on earth. And when I think of futurism, I think of like that's kind of where they're trying, what they're trying to create a heaven for humans on earth. That's their idealistic side of it, at least.
Well, now we look at like history, map making as these sort of like empirical things that are collections of facts. Like, oh, if I travel northwest 100 miles, I'm going to reach a predictable location. But that was not really the understanding through most of history. You know, map making had a lot of mythology mixed into it. So it's like, you know, you couldn't just travel a certain distance and find a place. You know, like you, things were seen as in a mythological sense. So, okay, we'll talk about Jerusalem. It was a real place. It got wrecked. And now people wanting to reestablish that religion, saying, oh, at one point there was a glorious castle that represented our temple of God, but it happened beyond a single person's memory. So it becomes an idealized memory. But then finally you get these group of knights who say like, well, it was a place and we can sort of predict it through these old maps and stories and actually dig up some of this stuff. And so their concept of a New Jerusalem was actually physical, was finding this stuff. But they also grew up with this mythological understanding. So they are trying to make the facts fit the mythology.
Well, what was that fantasy, that idyllic vision? When I look at this picture that's come up on the stream, I think it looks a lot like Thomas Kinkade to me. I mean, I'm seeing the same kind of colors and
Things I create with stability. Yeah, Neuschwanstein. I try to, because most of the descriptions of the kingdom of heaven are just these fantasy bullshit things of like gold and jewels and there's free pudding and there's no lines.
Ooh, free pudding.
Yeah, you know, it's just this idealistic catering to expectation. And that was the transition between the New Jerusalem being an actual place where like, okay, maybe there's running water and, you know, there's not, you know, there's some physical barriers that make it a nice place to call home, versus an idealistic place where, you know, wine is coming out of the faucet. And that's what the search for New Jerusalem becomes a dangerous thing. And let's talk about Columbus, who was driven by a search for New Jerusalem, who he married.
So I didn't know that. So they believed New Jerusalem was in the Americas?
Well, there were many places. It's not like America had never been heard of, but it was not traveled too extensively. But he married this Portuguese woman whose father was a master navigator and was a Templar. Portugal was one of the countries where the edict against Templarism was not enforced.
Interesting.
And so there's a, you know, it's hard to research because these were secret societies at the time. So it's not like they left records. I'm sure most of their their transitions were oral histories, but
they also
he had maps.
They also think that that Columbus was Jewish, and that it was a secret because of the Inquisition being
precisely
in full effect during this time, and that basically, what would you want to do? Establish perhaps a new Jerusalem somewhere else in a new place in the world?
So there's lots of conflict in the world.
Like,
you know, there's people who
are conspiracy, right?
Right, and
they
just
think it's real, which is the weird thing.
And he's coming off of the occupation of Spain by non-Christian forces. So they're really thinking, like, this world is tenuous, that we've got to go to some place of stability and purity. There's not these people believe other stuff. There's not diseases. You know, the what is it? The when corpses decay, was the old way of referring to it? Corruption of the flesh. So the corruption of society. They're trying to go to this place where they're going to be hermetically sealed. So when Columbus gets in the New World, said like, oh, there are these new people, let's learn about them. These are merely just stepping stones to his vision. And he was horrible to these people, even to the church back at home, who have no problem with slavery and, you know, the soulless opinions, being like, you can't just cut the hands off of children and expect that to be normal.
And you know, right, and regardless of whether they're heathens or not, right?
Yeah, well, we're not going to convert anybody.
It just makes me remember when this is before people started relooking at how we taught history, and it definitely in my history books there were pictures like the one I have on the style board. You know, like this victorious landing on the beach with the, you know, the flag of Spain and
discovering and, it, yeah, right? Well, even though there's a bunch of people
exactly. or this, like, just iconic images that never were, they are just icons of, like, Columbus holding the globe, like the globe was in his hands, right?
And idealized memory.
Yeah, and to me, that speaks to some aspects of futurism of, like, the new world was the, like, outer space was to us when we were growing up. And people looked at it and thought of it in those same kind of terms as, like, you know, Columbus was an astronaut of his time. And so hanging on to that and not, sullying the truth with truth of what is important.
Probably easy to sell the lie because there's no TV, there's no video. You've got a couple scribbly log notes where, you know, most people can't read, but they're seeing the gold. Ships full of gold coming back, right? And someone's just saying, yeah, it's great. You know, God's shining on us. You know, they're not talking about the suffering they're using to cause it. They're just seeing the ships of this beautiful, shiny ship.
Oh, that went on for forever. I mean, even unto the age. And one of the reasons why it was caused of the opium wars was that they basically drilled out the mines in, I guess, Peru, right? And so that's just crazy shit that we as a human Western ideology did to a group of people. And this is another one. The reason why we were able to do it is because the first contact killed 99% of the people in the Americas.
Right? No swords needed, no guns needed, right?
So they went there, they saw these people, they went back, and when they came back, there was nobody there to oppose them.
The ghost ship should have been the first contact, right? Just a plague.
Just send a few people. There's a really affectionate love kissing. So we gotta wrap this up. We're a little late. We're about 7 minutes over.
Nice. Well, I'm glad we at least got to cover the New Jerusalem.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And we're gonna get better at figuring out how to do time allocation and stuff like that. But everything here is really fun, and I just want to tell you guys how privileged I am to be able to do this with you guys, and how much I appreciate how long we've been doing this and our friendship and everything, and how, what a, you know, I just feel really grateful.
Well, it's good that each time we do it, it flows more.
Yeah, we're getting better at it. We're dialing it in. And it's about as good as doing a podcast on a Linux box can be at this point. So I love you guys. Thanks again. Thanks for coming to the Richest Family podcast. And we'll see you next time.
Take care, guys.
Bye. See ya.
Thanks for joining us for another amazing episode of The Richest Family. We hope that it made you think about weird stuff, or at least reconsider something you felt like you already knew. I think the audio went a little bit better this time. We've got some new techniques that are making it a little bit cleaner. You can also watch the video recording of this podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@ClayTantor. It would also really help us if you went to the YouTube channel and you liked and subscribed. We're trying to grow this channel so that people can share in this experience, so your help is appreciated. Or watch a stream live on twitch.tv/ClayTantor every other Sunday at 10 a.m. PST. Please tell your friends about this podcast. We're available on all streaming platforms, including Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, all for free. So thanks for showing up. Glad you're here, and hope you have a strange and interesting day.